And then I've also for the Zoom meeting, for the Zoom during the pandemic, it's been comforting and joyful experience to Zoom to a meeting these past few years. And it's important to recall the ULT declaration. The Philadelphia ULT meetings maintain anonymity. We offer no crosstalk or side issues of personal anonymity, of personal anecdotes. Participants speak directly to the chairperson when called upon. These are traditions which are designed to welcome all to the study of the philosophy of theosophy without distractions of any social differentiations or personal attributes. Let us all work to maintain these traditions. So we will now turn the meeting over to the chairperson for the meeting.
We will begin with a reading of the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists and a presentation of the announcements.
Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy, without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement. It does not concern itself with tensions or differences, individual opinion. Work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification and practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, founder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this ideal among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves, by study and otherwise, be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. Announcements for January 2nd, 2022. Lodge meetings are held to disseminate the fundamental teachings and principles of the philosophy of theosophy. The meetings are open to the public. At these meetings, participants are asked to address their comments to the chair rather than to each other, fostering and helping to maintain an atmosphere of impersonality is foundational to lodge meetings. All lodges are sustained by voluntary contributions of time, money, and work. It is these contributions which support lodge activities. To volunteer or make a contribution, please contact the Philadelphia Lodge and or the lodge of your choice. A listing of lodges can be found at the Phoenix Lodge website. Straight line theosophical materials mentioned may be purchased from Theosophy Company in Los Angeles, California. Downloaded from the Phoenix Lodge website and are purchased on site before and or after the Sunday morning meeting at the Philadelphia. Philadelphia Lodge. Podcasts of these meetings may be heard at the Philadelphia website. To disseminate theosophical teachings, the Philadelphia Lodge holds 3 weekly meetings, Sundays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. At the Sunday meetings, a broad theme is selected for presentation each month. Each Sunday, some aspect of that theme gets explored in detail through a forum, lecture talk, or panel discussion. The theme for January is the path of spiritual evolution. And today's lecture is the greatest lawful war. Next Sunday, the panel will discuss subduing the wandering heart. The door to Theosophy Hall opens on Sunday at 10:30, and the meeting begins at 11 and ends at 12 noon. Sunday meeting is the only on-site, in-person, and Zoom meeting. The Wednesday evening study class meets from 7:30 to 8:45. We are continuing our yearly study of the Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge. For the past few weeks, we have been studying the broad theme of the human constitution, and we'll conclude that study this Wednesday, January 5th, with the topic, Human Constitution, the Higher and Lower Mind. The Friday evening informal round table discussion group meets from 6:30 until 7:30. We have been discussing Echoes from the Orient, which is a broad outline of theosophical topics by William Q. Judge. This Friday, January 7th, Section 15 will be discussed. The Wednesday and Friday meetings continue to be through Zoom only, not on site. That concludes the general announcements. Next, there will be a reading, will be followed by the lecture for today. This reading is from the Bhagavad Gita, second chapter, entitled Devotion Through Application to the Speculative Doctrines. It is Krishna who is speaking. Cast but thine eyes towards the duties of thy particular tribe, and it will ill become thee to tremble. A soldier of the Kshatriya tribe hath no duty superior to lawful war, and just to thy wish the door of heaven is found open before thee. Through this glorious unsought fight, which only fortune's favored soldiers may obtain. But if thou wilt not perform the duty of thy calling, hide out the field. Thou wilt abandon thy natural duty and thy honor, and be guilty of a crime. Mankind will speak of thy ill fame as infinite, and for one who hath been respected in the world, ill fame is worse than death. The generals of the armies will think that thy retirement from the field arose from fear. And even amongst those by whom thou wert wont to be thought great of soul, thou shalt become despicable. Thine enemies will speak of thee in words which are unworthy to be spoken, depreciating thy courage and abilities. What can be more dreadful than this? If thou art slain, thou shalt attain heaven. If victorious, the world shall be thy reward. Wherefore, son of Kunti, arise with determination fixed for the battle. Take pleasure and pain, gain and loss, victory and defeat. Same to thee. and then prepare for battle. For thus and thus alone shalt thy inaction will be free from sin. Lecture today is entitled The Greatest Lawful War.
Friends, as we approach and are beginning the cycle of the new year, it is quite natural that our thoughts turn to the path of spiritual evolution, especially in this time when the psychic, the astral life of the earth is young and impressionable, and we can benefit from the higher impulse, the wave of rising spiritual and psychic impulse felt throughout nature at this time. And so the theme for this month of January is the path of spiritual evolution. Our first consideration is the greatest lawful war. And it might seem odd that in beginning such a lofty aspiration, our minds are drawn to the idea of war, battle, conflict, struggle. But there is a reason for it, and we'll explore that reason, that mystery today. We'll look at it from a philosophical perspective offered by theosophy. We'll look at it through a better and more complete psychological understanding of the nature of the human being. We'll look at it from the allegorical meaning of the lawful war and the often referred to war in heaven in many traditions around the world. And finally, we'll look to the devotional books for inspiration and guidance as to the why and how and reason we must pursue this greatest lawful war. So we'll begin with first principle, universal principles, which are a sure guide to our thought and action and a means by which we can begin to better understand the mysteries of life. And the first consideration is that of the origin, the mystery of the origin of life, of all things and beings, what we might call the divine deific principle, the one source, the one reality, the essence of all beings. It is a boundless, changeless, eternal reality that has no attributes. And yet everything that does have attributes, everything that manifests from the universe down to the smallest atom and particle, comes forth from that great unity and returns to it. And this universal divine essence pervading, sustaining all things during their time of manifestation is the basis of universal unity and the foundation of universal brotherhood, not just in thought, but in action and interaction. So we spoke of that periodical great breath, the in-breathing and out-breathing of Brahma, as it's sometimes referred to, the cosmic periods of manifestation, activity, and differentiation, followed by equally long periods of resolution, rest, and homogeneity. This grand cycle is the archetype, the prototype, the basis of every cycle we see in all departments of nature. It is the prototype and basis of the idea of reincarnation or re-embodiment or manifestation of the soul, the periodic embodiment in a form, in a personality, in a different nation or race of that same pilgrim soul throughout a long series of lives. And also the idea of karma, or the law of action and reaction, which brings back to the point of the origin of the action, the origin of the disturbance, the reaction that restores harmony and balance. These laws of cycles and action and reaction are seen throughout nature. And the third, first principle, we might say, because they all fall from that one principle we spoke of initially, is that of the universal process of evolution. Now, all souls being divine in essence are necessarily one with the universal oversoul, which is in itself a periodic expression of that ever-hidden, absolute, deific reality. But nevertheless, we need to realize that self-consciously, and that is the great goal of evolution, the self-conscious realization, the becoming self-consciously aware of our divine essence and origin and the interdependence of all life. That process of realization, that process of becoming self-conscious, proceeds very gradually throughout all the lower kingdoms of nature, the mineral, the vegetable, the animal, through the natural spiritual impulse of the soul, which present in all aspects of the being, drive evolution forward. And yet, once the human stage is reached and we acquire self-consciousness and through it free will and choice, our further evolution proceeds by self-induced and self-devised effort. And the effects of our further evolution are experienced not only on the physical plane and the mental plane, but also the spiritual plane. So this idea of there being a threefold process of evolution necessarily draws our mind to the idea that the human being in their nature is more than a physical body. Now we can start very basic and say that everything in life has an invisible informing spiritual aspect, one with that deific essence, and a physical form. And so we have the basic duality of spirit and matter. But there is also, as we said, that evolving acquired intelligence, which we may call the psychic or the intellectual stream, the whole evolution of soul. So the human being is not just a duality of spirit and matter, but spirit, soul, and a physical body. But we can further break down those three aspects and come with what we call the sevenfold division of man, the human being, which is a model, which is based on the great sevenfold division of the universe, because everything comes forth in that sevenfold way. So we have an immortal spiritual nature, a divine higher nature, what we call spirit, spiritual soul, and mind. And this is the immortal part of us, the immortal pilgrim that passes life after life through various personalities and physical forms, our immortal individuality, our higher self, whatever terms we use to distinguish it from the vehicle in any one life, which is fourfold. We have a physical body, obviously, which is continuously changing. We have an astral or design body, which is the model upon which the physical atoms arrange themselves and maintain themselves in that physical form. We have the passions and desires that drive our actions and affect the way we think and feel when incarnated. And then we have that life principle, that breath, that aspect of the one life that permeates all our lower principles. And so we are a sevenfold being. So this is the, we might say, the philosophical and psychological basis of the process. So how do we come from this to the idea of the greatest lawful war? And we understand war in general is, it's certainly a time of conflict, a struggle, a readjustment of the balance of power. And we understand that even on the physical plane, wars can be just. They can be to defend and protect what is lawfully one's, or defend and protect the weak and the suffering and the vulnerable. And of course, it can be unjust. It can purely be based out of greed, out of the lust for power and wealth and to dominate. But these wars on the physical plane are a reflex, an image of the war that goes on within each human being. So there is a psychological aspect, but there is even a higher aspect of this struggle. And so if we look across the tremendous period of evolution of the soul or the monad throughout all the different degrees of kingdoms, all the different degrees of being, and it finally reaches the point of self-consciousness, after all that spiritual unfoldment, now through individual effort, there are no gifts or privileges, that self-conscious ego or soul has to struggle to refine, to find its primary source with full awareness of its inherent unity and divinity. And when you think about it, the soul in its highest aspect is pure and spiritual, but it does not necessarily realize it. And that's the purpose of evolution. And the only way the soul can know itself is by understanding all of life, to gain experience in all of the different degrees of being. And so it is necessarily a pilgrimage, a journey from the realms of light and spirituality into ever-increasing depths of matter and form, into the darkness, and then by that self-energized effort to return to that light. And for the human ego, that soul, that journey is fraught with many obstacles, many struggles. Some are the natural result, the lawful necessity of the cycle of incarnation, where that infinite power and scope of spirit is naturally limited in its expression through a form, and naturally limited in its knowledge and understanding by the forms and the capacities of the forms it is involved in. But without that incarnation, it not only could not gain self-knowledge of its divine essence, but it would lose the opportunity to raise up all the life, the consciousness developing in those forms, in those lower degrees, to a higher degree. So it has a lawful duty and responsibility under the cycle, and it's fraught with obstacles and limitations, But some of those obstacles also come as a result of the law of karma, the lawful effects of causes set up by that ego, diluted in the form, and therefore makes erroneous and false and perhaps selfish decisions on how to act based on the illusions of separateness that come forth from relying too much on the senses and identifying too much with the physical body and being too much influenced by the passions and desires that we necessarily feel as embodied self-conscious beings. So this lawful war, this greatest lawful war, refers to the struggle for adjustment, spiritual, intellectual, and physical, throughout all the time of the evolution of the human being as he is now. And so that is what we're talking about, that adjustment that comes once we incarnate and begin to move back towards our spiritual unity. And so throughout history and all the traditions, Eastern and Western, we hear in various ways this idea of the war in heaven, which is ultimately a war or a time of conflict and adjustment between spirit and matter. And as we said from understanding our sevenfold nature, it is a time, it is a process which requires the adjustment of that outer terrestrial personality made up of those four lower principles to the inner divine man or the inner divine human being, the immortal reincarnating entity, to incarnate in that form, full the pull, full the influence of the lower lives and intelligences there, and yet struggle through effort to bring it in line, to make it a suitable vehicle for the aims and purposes and duties of the ego, which ultimately is to not only raise up all of life, but to find its own self-conscious unity and purification in realization of the one source from which it has come. So this war is a very real one, and until the passions that are so much part of our lower personality, until they are in some way subdued, they will be in lasting conflict with the aspirations of the inner divine man. And so at some point, there is a conscious choice made by the soul to pursue that path towards mastery of the principles, the mastery of our nature, and thereby mastery of all of nature. We might call it the path towards adeptship, which is the highest spiritual path possible on this earth for a human being. And so that war in heaven refers to the struggles, the trials of involved in the initiation. The inner enlightened man, the inner enlightened human being who begins to sense that there is more to their nature, there is more to life than this physical form, this physical reality, has either to slay the self-indulging passions in the nature or fail in the attempt, at least during that life. And so we have laid before us throughout the world in all times stories, allegories to continuously remind us of this greatest lawful war. And we opened our meeting today with a reading of the Bhagavad Gita. And those who have studied the Bhagavad Gita or have just read it for the first time realize that it begins on a battlefield. And that battlefield is symbolic of the struggle the lawful war that the true disciple faces in learning to bring the lower into subjugation, to make it an instrument of the higher divine will. Echoed by Jesus in the words, "The kingdom of heaven is taken by violence." Not so much physical violence, but certainly through struggle, effort, and an indomitable will, which has to subdue and destroy all those obstacles that lay in the way of its realization of what Jesus referred to there as heaven, or our spiritual reality. So that's the Bhagavad Gita, and Krishna in the reading referred to it as lawful war, which only fortune's favored soldiers may obtain. But we also have written for us the Voice of the Silence, a devotional book, which in the introductory page says it's for the few. And in the introductory remarks in the first few pages, it's for those who are seriously interested and devoted to the idea of gaining true spiritual knowledge, to know firsthand for themselves what is the path to be pursued. And what is striking about this book is it being, even though it's a book of devotion and inspiring and brings out the highest aspirations for self-sacrifice and benevolence and kindness and consideration for all that suffer, it is definitely a guidebook in the struggle, this highest war, and recognizes the reality of it. If we turn to the fragments 1, 2, and 3 that we have translated for us by H.P. Blavatsky, we see this. And throughout the Voice of the Silence, there are references to how we must overcome these different principles. And actually, the talks that we have planned throughout the next 4 Sundays in January discuss in turn the what is involved in controlling the wandering heart, what is involved in controlling the restless mind, what is involved in overcoming the illusions of the senses, the delusions of our thought, and what is involved in the victory of the virtuous mind, the virtuous moral being over these aspects of the lower nature. So we go to that first fragment 1, and we understand that this war, this greatest of wars, involves a subduing and mastering of the lower self and the inner principles, all those principles of the human being, especially the lower ones. It is said that an adept is measured by the number of principles that he or she has in their control. And if we understand that each of our principles is a reflection of powers and forces and processes in nature, then the control of our human principles necessarily helps us control and those inner forces of great nature. And so the great adept is not only wise in understanding and controlling their own nature, but also wise and beneficent in controlling the forces of nature. And yet it is a struggle, it is a war. And we read on page 12, when the 6, meaning the lower personality, is when the 6 are slain, that lower personality is destroyed, and at the master's feet are laid, then is the pupil merged into the one, becomes the one, and lives therein. And that theme follows many of the inspiring verses that we read and study throughout Fragment 1. And then in Fragment 2, we are definitely impressed that the path to pursue the path of spiritual knowledge necessarily requires us to face this war and either to conquer it or fail. And we read in Fragment 2 on page 43, "No warrior volunteering fight in the fierce strife between the living or the immortal higher ego and the dead, the lower personal ego, not one recruit can ever be refused the right to enter the path that leads to the field of battle. For either he shall win or he shall fall. Yea, if he conquers, nirvana shall be his. In him will men a great and holy Buddha honor. And if he falls, even then he does not fall in vain. The enemies he slew in the last battle will not return to life in the next birth that will be his." And then we read on page 47 these inspiring verses. "The Bodhisattva who has won the battle, who holds the prize within his palm, yet says in his divine compassion, 'For others' sake, this great reward I yield,' accomplishes the greater renunciation. A savior of the world is he." So in this second fragment, we understand that, yes, this path that leads to the war is not just for our own spiritual salvation, but also, as we said, our duty to lift up all other human beings, all other kingdoms of nature. And the victory of such a being is a victory for humanity and all the beings involved in that period of evolution. And they feel that upward impulse and rejoice, it is said symbolically, from that victory of the warrior soul. And then we turn to Fragment 3 because we're wondering, what's the purpose? What can be our motive for entering the fight? What's the importance of the struggle? Is it purely just a spiritual selfishness of wanting to realize for ourself our divine essence and perhaps the goal of nirvana, a long period of rest and assimilation into that divine essence? And we are taught in that third fragment, page 68 and 69, what the motive of the struggle, what the motive of the lawful war, and why it is the greatest lawful war. "If thou hast tried and failed, O dauntless fighter, yet lose not courage. Fight on, and to the charge return again and again. The fearless warrior, his lifeblood oozing from his side and gaping wounds, will still attack the foe, drive him out his stronghold, vanquish him ere he himself expires. Act then, all ye who fail and suffer, act like him, and from the stronghold of your soul, chase all your foes away. Ambition, anger, hatred, e'en to the furry shadow of desire. When even you have failed, remember, thou that fightest for man's liberation, each failure is success, and each sincere attempt wins its reward in time." So these very inspiring thoughts given to us from the philosophy, from a psychological understanding of the nature of the human being, from a study of the mysteries of the symbolism of the lawful war, the war in heaven throughout the world, and from a reading of the devotional books, is very helpful for it this time. Because like the beginner on that path, where everything seems bright and hopeful and the birds of radiance are giving out their joyful songs, before we begin to stumble and face the pebbles and the difficulties. At this time of year, we have high, lofty hopes and make those aspirations and will. But we will find as the days and weeks go on, the obstacles, the pull, the tendencies of our lower nature, which may have an inclination to discourage us. Many may give up their resolutions. But this reminder, or warning at the very beginning, that it is a struggle, it is a lawful war, it is a duty, is why we're here as warrior souls, as divine egos in evolution, is a good reminder to us that our duty is to fight, and that fight is most manifested for us by to ever keep trying, keep working at it, even if we fail in our ideal, in our attempts. There is no failure, but only the seeds laid for future progress if we continue to make effort every day the best we can. That's all we're expected to do, to act up to our highest ideals to the best of our capacities at this time. The adept is made through their own self-induced, self-devised effort through a number of lives. They are not born. It is not something that is endowed on them. They have to earn it through struggle. So we'll stop here at this point and invite your questions and comments on this thought-provoking subject of the greatest lawful war.
We have a question here in the lodge.
Yes, it was said in the talk that the soul does not know itself. So our question is, we were just a little curious because in the human, we are self-conscious. So if we're self-conscious, then why would the soul not know itself?
So the question is, can we reconcile the two ideas where it said the soul does not know itself, and yet we're self-conscious, so it seems that we would know ourselves.
So self-consciousness gives us the capacity, the possibility of reflection and knowing oneself. But what is that self that we are aware of? We are certainly aware of our physical bodies and personalities and memories. And for many of us, we form an idea of our personal self, which is different from the self of others. And so our understanding of person of self based on our limited experience in this life may be that of being self-consciously aware of ourselves as personalities separate from others. But then there is a higher stage. We can view ourselves as the individual self, the thinker, the observer, which is the same throughout the changes of the personality, and realize that every human being in contact with has that same individual, is also an individual thinker and has that same individual self. So now our realization of self through higher experience, we identify with ourselves as the observer, the experiencer. But there is another stage, and that is to gradually become self-consciously aware that we are one with an array of that universal oversoul, that intelligence, that force that is the manifested deific vitality throughout all of nature. The self of the adept is that universal oversoul. But even then, there's one higher step, because that universal oversoul is itself a periodic manifestation of the universal, hidden, unmanifested deity. So the highest possible condition of illumination is self-conscious realization that we are divinity. We are all sparks and one with deity in its nature. Not an intellectual understanding, but a direct spiritual knowledge and realization.
We have a chat that's been posted, and then another question here in the lodge. And the chat posted is from JF. Aren't we here to learn and then report back to our higher self about what we have learned? So that means that we, in a way, don't know ourselves 100%. Oh, and then we see in SL, it's been answered in the question.
Can always approach the question freshly, for sure. We think or know ourselves. We think we know ourselves, do we not? But even our psychologists would tell us that there's much in our motivation and our thought that we are unconsciously aware of, our subconscious. We do things for reasons we do not know. And maybe with the guide of a good therapist, or maybe through self-reflection and self-help and honest self-introspection, we realize that we were doing things in a way we could, we really didn't understand ourselves, not just the hidden motives that guide us, and the influence of previous experiences in this life that guide us, but also we really didn't know our fullest, highest potential, what we could really do if we put our will and thought and imagination to it. So through that experience every day, when we reflect on it, we become, even in this life, wiser, hopefully, and we're more aware of ourselves at the end of life than we were at the beginning. If we become innocent, it's not the innocence of ignorance like we were when we were children, but it's the innocence and purity of motive that comes from knowledge. And that's the difference. It's one thing to be spiritually divine, inherently, almost innocently, ignorantly. It's another thing to, through experience, having gained self-conscious realization that we are divine, and have all that wisdom based on that experience and know how to answer it. So we do not know ourselves completely 100%. And what's interestingly enough, because we are ultimately divine in essence, in any one great period of evolution, we can only relatively know ourselves to the highest degree possible, because the next period of evolution may give us new opportunities, new vehicles, new expressions to learn even more about what our potentiality is. It is said by the adepts that there are worlds within our solar system and worlds beyond our solar system where the level of intelligence and spirituality is higher than our own. Just as there are levels of intelligence and spirituality on other worlds that are lower than our own. But wherever, on whatever system, there is a self-conscious being working through our form, there we have the great struggle of humanity, in whatever form it may appear, of the higher divine man trying to overcome and lift up the vehicle it has acquired by nature.
Thank you. And we have another question here in the lodge.
It was stated that the six Lower are slain, and put at the feet of the master, as it were. If we're seven principal beings, we can understand the four lower principles, but we have manas, which we can understand too, that needs to be conquered. But buddhi would be in one of those six, the way we're counting it. And how could that be? Because buddhi is that the purest that we can access. So why would we be slaying buddhi? Or are we not? Or is there something else in there?
Did the chair hear the question?
So, so we understand, it's easier for us to understand that when we speak of principles, we're talking about the astral body, the passions and desires, the higher and lower mind, the physical nature. But then when we come to the idea of the buddhi principle, what does it mean for it to be slayed or subdued? And we might think of that, if we think of that pure monadic essence, that Atma Buddhi, the spiritual monad moving throughout the kingdoms of nature. Why is it doing so? Because even that Buddhi, that acquired knowledge, that spiritual knowledge, is not yet pure and not yet complete and not yet divine. It's not yet ready to be fully emerged into that highest divine essence. That's why it's engaged in this long period of evolution. That's what is meant by the spiritual stream of evolution. That buddhi, although spiritual and immortal in essence, is still a vehicle, still acquired knowledge, and still requires time to reach that point. Now, throughout the long period of evolution, it will do that, but it is possible for an individual ego, buddhi manas, to so purify their nature, that Buddhistic Buddhi essence can enter into that highest plane of unity, what is sometimes called nirvana, long before the natural cycle would end, and they become a mahatma or a nirmanakaya, a great self-conscious being working with that knowledge. So yes, buddhi is a spiritual principle, but it's not the immortal divine essence, and so its destruction there is really a metaphorical, refers to the transformation. When we speak of the death or destruction, we cannot speak of death and destruction without the other idea of regeneration. Remember the threefold aspects of the divine power: the creative, the preservative, the destructive, and regenerative. So that destruction of buddhi there, or the slaying of buddhi, means refining it, reforming it, making it pure, making the divine character that we carry from life to life in that Buddhistic nature ever more godlike in its potency.
Thank you.
MDW.
Yes. Are we trying to escape this world?
Some are. Some are trying to escape the world, meaning to liberate their minds from the struggles, the conflicts, the difficulties, the obstacles, and they're trying to escape the war, the heat of the battle. And so for them, victory is getting themselves in a position where they are not affected or feel the conflict. And so for them, the path is one of the of liberation, of reaching nirvana, where there is no self-conscious awareness of the differentiations of matter, of the forms and personalities involved in it, and no, certainly no awareness of the struggles of humanity and all the other sentient beings involved in evolution. But is that the greatest war? No, the greatest war is not to run away. The greatest victory is not to run away, but to engage through involvement, to engage with the understanding that we are divine beings and cannot be ultimately affected or destroyed by what we experience, but can, through our influence, subdue, train, and raise up and quiet the struggle around us, not only for ourselves, but for others. Now that takes patience, obviously. That takes courage, that takes strength, that takes wisdom, that takes every weapon in our spiritual arsenal, every virtue in our arsenal to be able to do that. But it is definitely not escaping life, is it? It's becoming involved with embodied life. I think there's a chat.
Yes, there is. So the chat again is from JF, but isn't accepting the war only creating an even heavier karma later on? Oh no, isn't escaping the war only creating an even heavier karma later on? Isn't it better to fight the war at hand now instead of later?
Of course it is. And we think we all recognize that to sweep something under the karmic cart, karmic carpet. saying that I'll just save it for my next life is not going to make things easier. It's only going to accumulate our debt. And we say that that's one of the reasons the soul incarnates. It incarnates because of its debts, because of what it hasn't done, because of the lessons it hasn't learned, the mistakes it makes. And so the more we withdraw from that responsibility, the heavier the debt we are sooner going to have to face. Even for that ego who enters nirvana, that nirvana condition is not eternal. But as we stated at the very beginning, periodically, after long periods of rest, assimilation with the divine, everything comes forth again, all the worlds and beings involved. And those who have escaped their natural duty to others by the spiritually selfish pursuit of their own salvation, we are told, face a great karmic debt and will have to make up for those lessons they did not learn in their previous incarnations.
MDW.
So in the simplest terms, are we to cultivate just love? Love of humanity, love of ourself, love of a life.
Of course. But love is a power. It's not a sentiment. Love is the expression of the spiritual will of our self-conscious realization that we are one with all. Thou art in me and I am in thee. And what affects you affects me because we are one. And realizing that, we wish the best for others just as we would wish it for ourselves. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. But that requires will and force and power and all the virtues we think of the warrior soul, the knight with a pure heart, engaging in the battle over supremacy. Because when we think about it, it's one thing to say that we love, but we can only do that if we've overcome all the obstacles of fear, doubt, prejudice, superstition, all the self-absorbing passions that we engage our minds in and forget our duties to those we say we love. So we cannot really love or truly love, even in our human sense, unless we engage in this battle. So we can conclude here, although we're not really finishing, because throughout the month we're going to explore the field of battle even more closely and gain what we can from it. So next Sunday we'll look at the wandering heart, and this Wednesday we look at the subject of the higher and lower mind, in other words, the two sides portrayed in the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, the two armies engaged in struggle with one another. So with that, we wish you all again Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Good weekend.